It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us again. Our coverage of all that's going on around the impeachment inquiry into President Trump's actions be with you throughout the course of the day, including at 1 o'clock live NPR coverage of the presidential news conference. But we turn our attention now to the automobile in Los Angeles. Perhaps only Detroit as a city has the kind of association with cars as Los Angeles does. It's a city that has been built around the automobile. Manufacturing was done here. Design of automobiles was done here. And as we're going to learn in the next few minutes, the whole way that car dealerships, showrooms, and the sales process developed largely came out of Los Angeles as well. Joining me is the chief historian at the Peterson Automotive Museum on Museum Row, Leslie Kendall. Leslie, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be here.
I appreciate it. Let's start first of all with just LA as a car-centric city. We're sort of developed in the right time for the automobile, didn't we?
LA and the automobile were born together, grew up together, and have been linked ever since.
And the manufacturing side of it, where were the different factories and which automakers had them here?
Well, early on, it was a lot of different factories. It was dozens of factories, people making cars one or two or three at a time and burping them out for 8 or 10 years. The 20s and 30s came along, and there was a great deal of consolidation in Detroit and Cleveland and St. Louis. And then it ended up doing a number on the little local manufacturers. But then the major Detroit folk came back with a vengeance and set up satellite plants in the area to take advantage of the labor force and the raw material supply lines that were here.
So is that the raw material supply lines, meaning we had railroad port access, that sort of thing?
Yes, we did. We had a lot of access to those things. What we did not have, and what is essential for supporting any kind of industry, is coal, timber, fresh water, and iron. L.A. did not have any of those things, but what we did have was a lot of people with a lot of talent.
And so let's talk about the factories. So General Motors had a large plant in Van Nuys, employed thousands of people.
They sure did. That closed, in terms of automotive history, not that long ago. And it's still pretty well remembered today. People drive by the freeway and go, yeah, I remember when they used to build GM cars over there.
And we also had the parts supply. Firestone had a huge tire factory here.
Right. It wasn't just the manufacturers. It was the people that supplied the tires, the bumpers, you name it. And there was also a great deal of oil here, too. So we also had a leg up on infrastructure.
Do you know, let's say off the top of your head, how many people at its height would have been employed in Southern California, generally automotive-related industry, design, manufacture, sales, all of it?
Well, depending on how you calculate it, hundreds of thousands would have been reached by that in all industries in general, including design, including maintenance, including manufacturing, all those sorts of things. Automobiles are very important to the economy because they employ so many people. So many people have things to do with either building cars, maintaining them, designing them, caring for the infrastructure that supports them.
How did Los Angeles become a design center for the automobile? What led to that?
Hollywood helped, I have to tell you, because Hollywood and the car grew up at the same time. They both took advantage of what made each other interesting, and that was motion. And Hollywood thought it was a very good idea for its stars to be seen in exotic, interesting automobiles, sexy cars. So if you had Tom Mix riding around in your 1922 Leach, then you were doing pretty good. And that helped propagate the enthusiasm for Los Angeles, and people started thinking, wow, that's a pretty cool place to be. They may not have the ability to make cars, but they sure have the means to enjoy them. We have the mountains, we have the deserts, we have the oceans, we have Sunset Boulevard, we have all those great places to see and be seen.
My grandfather had a cord that supposedly a gangster had been killed in, and it was
what higher compliment?
I was going to say, yeah, how much more L.A. than that can you get?
Oh, there's L.A. is a colorful place, colorful people, and may I say, colorful cars.
Absolutely. I'd love to hear your questions, your comments about Los Angeles and car culture, the manufacturing side, the design of automobiles, the sales of cars. You know, when I was a kid in the 1960s, you'd see car commercials on air all day long and live car commercials in the middle of the night. Guys would be sitting in car lots, sometimes with a dog alongside them, Ron Shuchem, people like that, doing car commercials, inviting people to come on down who'd undoubtedly work swing shift at a factory to come down buy a car at 11 at night. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. And speaking of the retail side of it, I'm joined by Daryl Holter, who's a car historian and CEO of the Shamus Group, which has owned the Felix Chevrolet dealership downtown Los Angeles since 1957. Up until a couple years ago, they owned the downtown LA Auto Group with those dealerships along the Figueroa Corridor, as well as the dealership in Carson. Daryl, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about the influence of car dealers as well, because, you know, my sense of local LA television in those early years, the 50s and 60s, you know, car dealers were propping a lot of that programming up.
Well, they did. I mean, of course, television was and radio before that was extremely important for advertising. But what I found in the research that I'm doing is that while the manufacturers were able to developed some very reliable cars by 1920, the first two decades were essentially a period when they were trying to figure out how to do that. And the dealers were coming in and trying to figure out how they would actually merchandise and sell cars. And the factories weren't that involved in those aspects of it. So it was dealers sort of working on a trial and error basis, figuring out how to do this. Of course, this is a startup industry. This had never been done before. And so the dealers played really an important role in linking the customer to the manufacturer. And they did this in a lot of ways. In one way, they provided the capital for the car makers to buy the parts that they needed to assemble their cars.
They fronted that money.
By getting deposits from customers. And so the dealers would give the deposits to the manufacturers, and the manufacturers, the early manufacturers, would use that capital to pay for the parts that they used to assemble the cars. And at the same time, the dealers were the ones that were building a sort of facilities and showrooms to accommodate car buyers that they were paying for themselves. And initially, cars were purchased all by cash, only by cash. Banks refused to lend to car buyers. It was viewed as a craze, a fad. And so LA dealers would start experimenting with deferred payments and promissory notes that allowed less affluent customers to buy cars.
Daryl, one of the things that strikes me when I see some of the old dealerships, and we have some here in Pasadena that have been adapted for reuse, is they were not very big at all. And I'm wondering, did you just have like one example of each model and people would put in an order to get the car, but they wouldn't necessarily test drive the actual vehicle they're purchasing?
Okay. Initially, the first auto row was on Main Street. And essentially, the dealers there would just widen an opening of a door so they could get a car in. They would put one car in there. It was called a demonstrator. And that demonstrator would be used to show people what this car would look like. And then they could drive it around the block if they knew how to drive it. And then if they wanted to buy it, they could put a deposit on it. And the dealer would send the deposit to the manufacturer. The manufacturer would make the car. And eventually it would be shipped to Los Angeles and the customer would come and get it.
So you wouldn't have a chance. Like now, you go on a lot, you actually drive the car, you're interested in buying. You couldn't do that. You'd agree to buy it before you even drove it.
You know, everything became more complicated as the industry grew. Initially, as I said, cars were sold for cash. And initially, dealers didn't provide any service. There were no warranties. They didn't exist. And so the first dealers would say, well, if the customer needs service, you know, go down the street. There's a guy that hung an auto repair sign on his place and maybe check that out. Eventually, the dealers start coming up with their own sort of little warranty plans until finally, as we get closer into the closer to the 1920, the manufacturers started offering it.
All right, we'll take a break, come back. Our conversation with historian Daryl Holter. He's the CEO of the Shamus Group, which has owned Felix Chevrolet downtown since 1957. Also with us, Leslie Kendall, chief historian at the Peterson Automotive Museum. Jim in Studio City asks, why have all the colorful car designs gone away? We'll get an answer to that question coming up in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Cars are such a huge part of Greater Los Angeles's culture. We talked a few weeks ago about racing and how that was centered here. Right now, we're talking about the manufacturing, the design, and the selling of cars and its significance to Los Angeles. You have questions for our guests. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Our guests are chief historian of the Peterson Automotive Museum on Museum Row in Los Angeles, Leslie Kendall, and historian and car dealer operator himself, Daryl Holter. Jim in Studio City asks, why have colorful car designs gone away? I feel like today's cars are monochromatic, and we used to have jewel-toned cars from my childhood. Jim asks, Leslie?
Well, today driving is a serious business. People don't look at it as an adventure, as a means to get away. They look at it as they look upon it as a kind of a necessary evil. And when you have when you're interacting with something that embodies a necessary evil, I don't know that it lends itself to colorful gestures and that kind of extroverted exuberance that you once had in the 50s. Things were pink and yellow and green, and you had these marvelous choices. That's because America was on top of the world. I mean, we were feeling our oats. We were very carefree. We can do anything kind of place. Now it's we're locked into cars. We have to have them. And the public wants cars that can go fast on freeways. They want cars to get good mileage. They want cars that embody all these characteristics. And when you come right down to it, cars converge on a certain cars for a given purpose and size all converge on the same shape, and they eventually converge on the same color. Now it's getting a little bit more interesting. We're seeing more browns out there, mm-hmm. which I think is absolutely fascinating. I've seen more orange cars in the past year than I have my entire life.
Yeah, that does seem to be happening. I would argue that we're a kind of a staid period in design generally, that just even how people dress, it's not a particularly colorful time, and we just seem to be going through one of those periods where we're kind of somber in our design.
Well, I think we're being a little bit more serious than we have a lot of times before. I think we first got a taste of that seriousness during the Depression, and then, of course, during the gas crisis of '73. About that time, convertibles went away, and we forget about that extroverted, open air, you know, come one, come all motoring feeling, and vans became interesting. We kind of withdrew into vans.
These little isolation
chambers on wheels.
We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Daryl, I want to go back to you and ask you about the early plants here where the cars were made. Were they largely assembling facilities more than anything else?
Well, initially they were largely assembling cars. They would go out and get a wagon. They would go out and get four bicycle wheels. They would go out and get some engine, a steam, electric, gasoline, and they would maybe put a tiller on it so that they could steer. I mean, that's the simplest formula. I'm breaking it down, but they were assembled. So there were probably 15 to 20 of these small car makers in L.A. Hand assembling a lot of these cars. But then there was a very interesting one called the Tourist, which was functioning in L.A. manufacturing, sold something I've seen between 3,000 and 5,000 vehicles between 1902 and 1910. And that was the Tourist here in Los Angeles. There is a Tourist that's on display at the Natural History Museum. You can go and look at it. The company closed in 1910, citing financial problems caused by selling cars on credit and the increase of rent on Main Street. As the automobile dealerships became more complex and needed more space, they started to evolve. They moved to the west over on Olive Street, so that in 1910 there were 105 brands of cars being sold by 70 dealers on the Olive Street area. Eventually, in the next decade, as they needed more space, they moved over to Figaro and Flower Street. So by 1927, there were 52 new and used car operations on Figueroa. Is that the
52 on Figueroa?
Yes, 52 brands of new and used. And, you know, that became then the Auto Row, and people kind of forgot about the other ones. If you go to a restaurant in downtown, if you go to the Palm Restaurant, you'll have a good example of a 1926 automobile dealership that was built as an automobile dealership.
And, of course, the 20s, boom years for Los Angeles. Construction just you look at any of those silent films from the 20s, everything's a construction site. They're just – the whole city seems like it's being erected in the 1920s. And there's a lot of money, and I assume, Leslie, a lot of cars sold.
There are a lot of cars, a lot of money. You're right. A lot of people are becoming very successful here. And the rail lines that led you to population centers were becoming less and less important because people spread out. Cars allowed people to spread out, so spread out they did. And, you know, nobody left at exactly the same time from the same place to go to this same work spot every morning. So we ended up being very reliant on cars, and all those dealerships helped.
Is there a particular car designed here that we think of as iconic that was designed in Los Angeles? We can say that for sure.
What I can tell you is that so many, virtually every manufacturer with an international presence has a design studio in one of three Southern California counties, San Diego, Orange, Los Angeles. And also right in the backyard of where we are now in Pasadena, the Art Center College of Design.
A few doors down from us.
They graduate more car designers than anywhere else. But so many things came out of here. It's very hard to find a dealership or walk by a lot that does not have some direct relationship to Southern California, to people who design cars here. This is a sexy place to be. You know, this is the place when you design cars, you want to be in the thick of it. And that's the whole idea.
So let me put in the plug for the Peterson Museum, where you're the chief historian, because there are remarkable examples of this history of Los Angeles so that we better understand it. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Daryl, about the Felix cartoon character on your neon sign. How did that come to be? How did you get the rights to Felix?
What happened was that Pat Sullivan, who was the designer of Felix the Cat, was a friend of Winslow B. Felix, who was the owner and the first owner of Felix Chevrolet. They became friends, and they began to cross-market the Felix Chevrolet with Felix the Cat. And so the cat was used for advertising beginning in 1921, with the beginning of our store in 1921. And that relationship has continued to today. I mean, we have a lot of Felix the Cat, Felix Chevrolet products.
I remember when the cartoons would show on television, you know, after school, there'd be Felix Chevrolet ads hand in hand.
The Felix Chevy website has a lot of the history, so people can check that out and you'll get
a lot of
this history.
Daryl Holter, Leslie Kendall, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next. And, of course, 1 o'clock, the live news conference, President Trump, NPR's coverage here on 89.3.